This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Domestic violence used to be a dirty secret. Neighbors, family members, even law enforcement used to see it as a family matter, better left to the individuals involved. Well, that's changed. Now we see this as a crime. But there's another aspect of relationship violence that is still lurking in the shadows, and that happens among people at a very much younger age. Our guest today started looking into the health effects of dating and sexual violence among high schoolers in Kentucky. She's now turned her attention to college campuses, and that attention comes at a time when colleges and universities are finally beginning to change their approach to the problem. UNC Charlotte is part of the effort to prevent violence on campus, and they invited Dr. Ann Coker to share her expertise. Dr. Coker has not only studied the problem, she has designed an active bystander program to empower students to reduce violence among their peers. Dr. Coker is speaking on the topic at the university this afternoon and joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. She's an epidemiologist, actually a professor of epidemiology at the University of Kentucky Center for Research on Violence Against Women. Also with us in our studio, Nicole Madonna Rosario, UNC Charlotte's interpersonal violence education specialist, and Melissa Siegel Barrios, an information education coordinator for Mecklenburg County Community Support Services. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good morning. Doctor, you made a career out of studying the health effects of partner violence. And aside from the obvious, what have you learned that might, through your studies, that might surprise us, or maybe it's something that we hadn't thought of before with regard to relationship violence?
Well, one of the things that really surprised me was that the effects of psychological violence or emotional violence has really the same physical health effects and mental health effects as does physical domestic violence.
Really?
Yes. And when we saw that in our data, and this was in the mid-90s, we were very surprised and went back and looked at it, specifically looking at individuals who are reporting only experiencing psychological violence relative to women who've never experienced violence. These were studies that we did in primary care facilities. So these are women who are coming in for other things, and we were asking about their experience with violence and a range of different health effects.
Now, you studied this among high school, as I said, high school students in Kentucky. That really actually shocked me yesterday when I started reading about this, because relationship violence is something you associate with married couples or older adult couples who have been together for a while, not with people who are dating, not with young people. I mean, what would make you continue to date somebody who abuses you physically or psychologically?
Well, I would like to say that actually the better time to really study this and what we're all about here on this panel is prevent it, is actually starting at a much younger age. So certainly by middle school, you have the potential for relationships that are troubled. So high school is almost too late.
Wow.
Yeah. So it really looking at even late in elementary school. And bullying prevention now is in kindergarten and in elementary school age.
So this has its roots in bullying.
Well, it's interesting. We of course, in academics, we have all these names for things, but there is something described as a continuum of violence. So bullying, those individuals who bully as younger individuals may become sexually harass others. Sexual violence is another part of that continuum, and dating violence and then intimate partner violence as an adult. So there is a continuum that it helps us in terms of intervention or prevention kinds of work. So we know that there are links between types of violence that help us in terms of reducing the risk as a person ages.
Nicole and Melissa have been nodding vigorously as you've been talking about this, particularly when she was saying that this actually begins in middle school. The signs begin to emerge in middle school. You have experience with this in Charlotte, I take it, Melissa.
So we're working in the middle and high schools in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area to really talk to young people about this issue. And when we talk to young people, as well as when we talk to parents, it's really important to help them understand that this conversation has to start earlier. And, you know, it's not the same conversation. You're not having the same conversation with a high school student that you're having with an elementary school student. But if you start teaching some of the principles around having respectful relationships from a young age, you can build off that to have later conversations about things like consent, things about respectful dating relationships. All of those things build off of each other. And if you wait until someone is going into college to have conversations about consent and you've built no foundation, then there's no way to help them grasp those concepts.
So if this has its roots in bullying, which starts probably in the middle school years for a lot of kids, maybe even earlier for a lot of kids, is it a matter of short-circuiting the behavior and giving letting these young people, these children, see options to their behavior? And if you don't short-circuit, is it a cumulative effect over time because it's a self-rewarding behavior?
Well, I think repetition is key, right? So if we introduce these concepts and ideas at a very young age and have clear, consistent messaging consistently through their education all the way up into college, the likelihood that they're going to repeat behaviors that they may have done once or twice is pretty low, right? And then the likelihood that they'll even start them to begin with is very low. And we definitely know that with other habits and other types of behaviors to be true.
You've led me to believe that this is a relatively new discovery, that this begins this young. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But if that's the case, if it's a new discovery, this means that this is not a new phenomenon. We're just learning about it now. It's been going on for a long time, forever.
Absolutely the case that it's been going on for a long time. We just really haven't been addressing it. I mean, you started the hour with it used to be a taboo topic. Now we're in a place where we can talk about it. A lot of work has gone into making that the case. And now we have the opportunity not only to recognize and intervene, but actually prevent the violence. And that, to me, as a public health professional, is really exciting.
And we've only been hearing about sexual violence on campus, on college campuses, for a couple of years now. When I went to college, we didn't hear about it. And I went to college in the 70s. We'll leave it at that. But we didn't hear about it back then. I know it occurred, but we didn't hear about it. Are we hearing about it today because there's a raised awareness of it, because we talk about these things publicly now, or because more people are reporting it because we talk about these things publicly now and there's a raised awareness of it?
The latter. We're definitely seeing we're talking about it more. So we, of course, really believe potentially that there's an increase in violence. There really are issues of violence outside of campus phenomena and that we don't really talk about because we're focused right now so much on what's going on in college campuses. But it's really that age group that has the highest risk of violence. Just so happens we're focused right now on those that go to college. That doesn't mean violence does not happen in other populations same age.
Right. Wow. Nicole, how big a problem is this on the campus at UNC Charlotte, sexual violence?
Well, I've been a trauma therapist. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I've been a trauma therapist for about 12 years, and I've been seeing this consistently. I think what's happening is that we're giving the issue more attention, so more people are coming forward.
So define this. Obviously, rape is sexual violence, but there are other forms of sexual violence, correct?
For sure, yeah. So on our campus, what we call sexual misconduct is sexual assaults, stalking, and dating and domestic violence.
A sexual assault outside of rape would be?
Unwanted fondling or touching, unwanted kissing, sexual harassment falls under that category. So it can be anything in between, and it can happen to anyone. Many of my education programs are geared towards gender-neutral audiences because we know that sexual assault rates are high among young men as well as women and as well as transgender-identified folks and LGBT-identified folks. So we try to be very open so that it's a safe space for everybody to report so that they can get help. Because the issue is getting somebody connected to help, for me anyway.
When this happens, is this because of a pattern of bullying in the abuser's life or the assaulter's life, or is it simply hormones at work here? And an atmosphere that might lend itself to permissiveness.
I think one of the things that is important to know is that, again, this is not an issue that's been just newly researched. So Dr. David Lisak has been looking at what he calls the undetected rapist in college campuses for many years. And what he's said, just, you know, in summary, is what we know to be true, and the majority of young men are not assaulting anybody on campus. They're not enacting these behaviors. It's the minority of men, and that minority is repeating the behavior. So, and because of victim blaming and the stigma of being a victim of a sexual assault, many of those victims are not coming forward and mm-hmm. talking about it, right? So these people who are committing these acts are allowed basically to keep continuing doing them, right?
You too are nodding as Nicole talks, Melissa, about this, I'm sure, and you work in the community at large. This is a pattern that's not exclusive to the college campus.
Exactly. And what we know is that this is a learned behavior, right? Mm-hmm. So they learn it from somewhere, and it could be that they learned it from seeing it in their home, but it could also be that they've learned it from their peer groups. They could have mm-hmm. learned it from the media, from pop culture, from the society at large, basically not taking a stand in a really large way and saying that this is not okay, we will not allow these types of behavior. And so when we see all of those things together, that teaches young people that this behavior is okay. When they see their favorite TV show and they see this excessive jealousy and it's played off as being cute, mm-hmm. then they start to believe that it's okay to be excessively jealous with my partner mm-hmm. and to be emotionally and verbally and digitally abusive to them because I'm excessively jealous of what they might be doing.
I was trying to think of an example where I saw on television jealousy, and it was cute. Are you talking about sitcoms?
Any romantic mm-hmm. comedy mm-hmm. has this idea of if I just keep showing up at their house, if I just keep giving them gifts, if I just keep persisting, they'll date me. And most of the time that movie ends in a marriage. And yes, of course, we all want a little bit to be pursued and to be treated specially and give gifts and things like that. But that's also could be defined as stalking.
Yep.
Can we just solve the problem right now by saying the movies are not real? Can we just stop it right here?
But when young people's reality is all about yeah. those things, yeah. they start to believe that those things are real, that that's how real life should be. They start to imagine that. And so if they're not actively analyzing those things, then they may believe that.
What is the influence of certain kinds of music? Rap music comes to mind with regard to this, because the lyrics in rap songs are sometimes violent, sometimes sexually violent, sometimes demeaning to women. Does that seem to lock in with certain people as acceptable behavior because they heard it on a CD or a MP3 or whatever?
Well, it's definitely not limited to one genre of music mm-hmm. because in my Healthy Relationships presentation that I do on campus, the song I feature is a song by Taylor Swift, actually.
Really?
Which
one?
Blank Space.
Okay.
Listen to the lyrics again, everyone.
All right.
Yeah. Not knocking Taylor, but I do use it in every presentation, and it's pretty mind-blowing for a lot of the students because many of them will talk about how they've heard that song a million times, but they've never actually listened to the lyrics. So it's just sort of getting in there and they're not really understanding. And because it's a woman who's enacting some of the violent behavior, mm-hmm. we also don't think about it.
Are victims more likely to report this than they were 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 15 years ago?
When we do studies, we don't necessarily see higher rates over time. In fact, the rates have not gone down, which is part of the concern because more than 15 years ago, there's a national survey. Rates that we collect from those data do not differ from what we're seeing now. However, there's been a fair amount of legislation, the Violence Against Women Act, mm-hmm. which we would hope to reduce rates of violence, and we're not seeing that difference. We are seeing, though, an increase in men reporting violence
against them.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that we don't even know if the rates on college campuses are rising. We just know that the number of reports have increased. Is that what we're hearing here?
That's correct.
Okay. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about this and get into some solutions and yeah. into a particular program that you are mm-hmm. Fundamentally responsible for, Dr. Coker, with dealing with bystanders. We'll talk about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and WTVI PBS Charlotte, presenting Carolina Impact, highlighting low-income families in Charlotte trying to climb out of poverty, and a local company that makes high-tech military products. Carolina Impact tonight at 8 p.m. on WTVI PBS Charlotte. This city is largely thought of as a banking town, but the healthcare industry employs over 100,000 people, from doctors and nurses to scientific research folks and pharmaceutical manufacturing. And tomorrow on this program, guest host Michael Thompson we'll talk with some of the people involved in making Charlotte a health hub about the health industry's economic impact on the city, the future of healthcare, and the impact of the Affordable Care Act so far. That's tomorrow morning at 9. By the way, if you missed our special voter roundtable yesterday on Charlotte Talks, you can go back and listen to it on our website, wfae.org/charlottetalks. And we will be doing more of these during this election year. So if you're interested in participating in a future show, let us know.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, cases of the Zika virus have been reported in at least 21 countries in the Caribbean and North and South America. The mosquito-borne virus is suspected of causing brain damage in infants and paralysis in adults. Efforts to control the spread and prospects for a vaccine.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about sexual violence, particularly on college campuses, with Dr. Ann Coker, professor of epidemiology at the University of Kentucky Center for Research on Violence Against Women. We're going to talk with her in a moment or two about some solutions to this problem. Nicole Madonna-Rosario is an interpersonal violence education specialist at UNC Charlotte. They have brought Dr. Coker to town to speak this afternoon at 2 o'clock. And Melissa Siegel-Barrios is an Information Education Coordinator for Mecklenburg County Community Support Services. In addition to your work there, Melissa, you were the co-creator and coordinator for the Love Speaks Out Speakers Bureau on Teen Dating Violence, and are the former chair of the National Youth Advisory Board for Love is Respect, which promotes healthy relationships. The existence of these programs seems to indicate this is a very big problem. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. The national numbers that we're looking at are 1 in 3 young people experience dating abuse. And when we look at that number in an average classroom in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, we're talking about at least 10 students.
For a young person, a teenager, a high school freshman, is that what you're talking about? Or
yeah.
You're talking about younger than that. What is dating violence? What is it?
So our definition of dating violence is it's a pattern of behavior where one partner is exhibiting abusive behaviors to gain power and control over their other partner.
And those behaviors would look like what? I'm trying to identify what it would look like.
Yeah.
Maybe I did it when I was a kid. Maybe I saw it when I was a kid, didn't recognize it. What is it?
So it can look like name calling. It can look like put downs. It can look like the physical abuse is more obvious, right? The hitting type behavior. But it can also look like digital dating abuse, which we're seeing a lot more.
Mm.
It can look like forcing them into sending nude photos. It can look like using social media to track their movements, who they're spending time with, mm-hmm. and use that against them to say, you know, why are you spending time with these people and not with me? And using that excessive jealousy to control mm-hmm. their behavior.
But why? I mean, I can understand years ago, women stayed in these relationships, these abusive relationships, because of economic reasons. And this is way long ago, prior to the women's movement. They couldn't get out of those relationships. But in a dating relationship where you're 15 years old, you're 16, you're 17 years old, and your boyfriend, your girlfriend is abusing you, calling you names, manipulating you, making you feel bad about yourself, why stick around?
I think the biggest thing is fear. When we look
at
the most dangerous time for someone in an abusive relationship is actually when they leave. Mm-hmm. 75% of homicides in dating and domestic violence relationships happen when the person is leaving or has just left.
Absolutely.
So sometimes telling someone to just get out of an abusive uh-huh. relationship can actually put them in more danger.
And wow. remember what it's like to be 15. You yeah. just want to belong. Right. You don't really know yourself yet, right? Our brains are not fully developed to make these decisions. So sometimes I also have to check myself when I'm doing my education on campus because I forget what it's like mm-hmm. to be 18 and new somewhere and, you know, want to belong and make friends and be part of groups. And that's a big part of it because as adults, we don't necessarily think that way all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But we did when we were those ages.
Well, that's the other
right?
side of it, because yeah. one of the things we used to hear about, and we still probably do, in terms of married couples who go through this, the woman will often stay around because he didn't mean to do that. He's always very sorry, and he apologizes, and he'll never do it. He says he'll never do it again, and they stick around, and what do you know? It happens again. So if you want to belong, you can use those same sets of excuses, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, and the other thing, too, to remember or learn for the first time, right, is when we see, especially like when I see a student in crisis, they've spent already many months and or years with an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And the first part of dating is not violent. They're charming, they're kind, they're loving, they're caring. They're all those things that we want in a partner. And in part, that's part of this cycle of abuse. And it's part of the sort of the manipulation and the psychological control that has to happen in a couple before they can move on to the next stages of abuse.
The first part sounds all very nice and warm and fuzzy. So why flip the switch? Why does the switch flip on these people who then turn out to be abusers of a relationship? What causes that?
Well, I think one of the things that I wanted to come back to in both the points that have been made is the power and control, particularly that coercive control. And stories are told that, for example, if you tell anybody what's going on in this relationship, I will kill myself, kill your – and this is dramatic. Don't get me wrong here. But there are those ways in which the abusive partner controls a situation and the ability for that individual to get out of a relationship, even if the violence is only, quotes around this, psychological.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but my question was, why does the abuser go in that direction? If everything is really wonderful at the beginning because he's being nice and it's all warm and fuzzy, why make that switch? Why not just stick with what's working? Why become controlling and manipulative and why go into this power mode when you've already got the power because it's working?
A lot of I feel like a lot of the young people who engage in these behaviors have learned it at home at some capacity. And I don't know the exact statistic off the top of my head of that of if what that is. Maybe you know it, Melissa, but it's pretty frequent. I mean, when you're 15 and you're exhibiting these behaviors, you are getting it from somewhere.
Well, this is part of the cycle of violence that we've talked about so many times on this show.
Exactly.
If you grow up around it, that's all you know.
Exactly. You're not given other options, which is one of the reasons why prevention programming at young age is really, really important. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't know another way at 15, you can't make another decision.
Nicole, you say that survivors and helping professionals often hear this question, why don't they leave? We've just talked about this. But you say that there are biases and systems that created barriers to seeking help.
For sure. Particularly in our marginalized communities, right? So people of color, people who identify as transgender or lesbian or gay or bisexual, or men, right? Male survivors, there's no specific shelters to go to. There's no specific places to seek help. As a therapist for many years at an institution in New York City, quite the majority of my survivors who were clients were men. And they had no other place to go.
And they were being abused by?
They may have had a history of abuse by a parent or a friend or someone that they were dating, particularly sexual abuse. I saw that a lot more. And I continue to see it.
Sexual abuse by their female partners or their male partners?
Mostly by – well, it didn't matter.
It didn't matter.
And it was probably one of the first times that I'd ever told somebody. But there was no real space for them to feel safe to talk about it.
I don't know that we can talk about this on the radio, quite honestly, but how are men sexually abused? Because I think people would are puzzled by that.
Men are – so sexual abuse is also about power control, right? So particularly for male survivors of childhood sexual abuse, which is what I saw mostly.
Okay.
I think they come forward a lot more than adult survivors do.
But these are not – what I'm getting at here, these are not necessarily people who as adults are being abused. It happened earlier in their lives.
It certainly happens with men of adult age, and the statistic is all over the map. Sometimes you hear 1 in 18. Sometimes you hear 1 in 70. And the reason for that is that they're not coming forward at older ages because people don't think that they can be assaulted, right? But anybody can. And men can be assaulted in the same ways as women can be assaulted.
Can you spot abusers? Can you look – is there a personality profile of abusers that professionals such as yourselves can look at somebody and watch their behavior and say,
Well, it's interesting. I'm going to use this as a segue to get to prevention because there is research, and you mentioned David Lysak's work. That is really looking at what we call typologies. And so from that typology – and these can be very, very charming individuals. And that's what's confusing for particularly young women who are really charmed by men who then do the switch, which we don't really know why happens, but it is part of their courtship behavior at some level. Those are not words that we currently use in terms of talking about dating, but there are ways to really identify people who may become violent, either psychologically or physically. And there are checklists that mm-hmm. Melissa, you probably have checklists that you're using with your project, I would yeah. think. So there are ways that you can go online and Google this kind of thing now so that you can identify the types of behaviors, not necessarily the typology of the individual, but the types of behaviors.
Are there certain people who make good targets and that abusers recognize?
Yes. And those are likely people who have, we mentioned child sexual abuse in the or physical abuse in the past. Mm-hmm. So they are vulnerable in that way. They've experienced violence in the past, may see it as part of a normal relationship. They may see it from that
perspective. Do potential abusers look for that? Are they seeking somebody like that? Or will they simply act the way they're going to act with anybody because that's their role model? They've been patterned after that.
Well, research shows that, and I can't speak for what perpetrators are looking for, and that's the language that we use. But the data suggests that those people who've been victimized in the past are at greater risk of being victimized in the future, now and in the future.
Okay. You have helped devise something called the Bystander Program.
I'm one of many people who are trying to use a bystander approach. And Melissa, I'm going to go back to your description of using your interventions, looking at social norms. And we've talked about it actually with the music
right.
that we these are ways that in societally we communicate what is appropriate behavior. And we've actually been talking about opportunities for prevention and what we just talked about in terms of can you identify people mm-hmm. who may become violent. That's information that we all can use. And the bystander approach is unique to an individual approach to prevention of violence. And that is, it's everybody's business that we reduce the risk of violence. So everybody, men and women, have a role in that. And I can say I'm a mother of two sons. And whenever I start talking about violence against women, they're just checked out because they don't see it as having to do with them or that there is a blaming. When you're talking about a bystander approach, you're really including everybody. You're not in a place where you're talking about victims and perpetrators. You're not dividing in that way. And it's much more positive. Mm-hmm. So then that's really attractive because you're not talking about this is a woman's problem. You're actually talking about a societal problem. And then what you can do is much more positive. We're all in it together. It's a community venture. And that makes everybody really engage. You're not blaming. It's that from that perspective, really attractive.
And go ahead.
I was just going to say, and young people are so used to being told, you know, don't do this, don't do that. If you know, you're going to get abused, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And so when you approach it from a different perspective, this is what you can do to help mm-hmm. your friends and peers.
Right.
It's so much more engaging
for
them.
Well, you bring it because young people they go through these driver education classes where they don't drink and drive, don't text and drive,
yep.
don't do this, don't do that. And at some point, you just get – I would think you just shut down. So how do you make this kind of information resonate with young people? How do you do it?
That's the million-dollar question.
But it's not about don't do this. It's actually about –
do this.
Yeah. It's learning how you can make an impact on your friends, which is really attractive because people are – they're very socially connected. And so if you can find ways to keep each other safe as a language or make the right choices or make good choices, keep each other safe, that way, you know, you're really looking at your positive impact in your close environment as well as further out.
I think the other thing we do is we talk about it from the perspective of promoting healthy relationships instead of stopping dating violence. Mm-hmm. Because if you promote it from that perspective, we all want positive, healthy, fun relationships. So when you come from that perspective, it can help them kind of feel like, oh, yeah, I want to be a part of that. That sounds awesome.
So how do you do that? What do you say to these young people? And in what setting? I mean, is this a class? Or is this a part of a freshman orientation program? Is this something that goes on as an extracurricular meeting after classes at the student union? How do you do this?
All of the above. Wherever I can get an audience, I go. Whether it's in a new student orientation, 30 minutes with one of the fraternity chapters on a Sunday night at 8 o'clock, I'm there. And I'm there in whatever capacity they need.
What kind of reception do you get at a fraternity at 8 o'clock on a Sunday night?
Fraternity men are very respectful to young men, and they ask great questions, and I'm going there because they've invited me, and that's one of the things that I prefer, to be invited to some of these spaces, because then I know that there's a reason, right?
Yeah.
So, and one of the things that I talk about with all my audiences, no matter where I am, is the value system that we were all raised with, right? We were not all, even if we've grown up with violence, you're not necessarily purposefully raised to be violent, right? So where do those values go when you step foot on a college campus in our country? Where do they go? Why do you engage in these behaviors? We're not those people, right? And I'm a social worker, so I was raised career-wise in a strength-based language setting. So that's what I do. I talk about their values and what means a lot to you. Who are the people in your life? Not just women, because I want them to understand that their brothers can also be hurt and harmed, right? I want them to understand that they need to look out for everybody. Because when we talk about only a couple genders, then we're dividing everybody up still, and they're still not thinking that everybody is a family member, so to speak, right?
A White House task force has called these programs, these bystander programs, among the most promising prevention strategies. You found them to be so, I would imagine.
We're in the process. Well, we're in the process of evaluating these programs, and I would really like to talk about that. But I want to say that bystander programs are now required on college campuses. That's part of the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act that was signed in 2013.
Okay.
And so college campuses that receive Title IX funds, which are all public universities, are required to implement bystander programs. They are not required to evaluate the programs, and there's no requirement as to whether they're mandatory, how you implement them, in any of those. So we don't really know whether bystander programs are – which programs are effective. There are lots of different bystander programs. So there's a real – from my perspective, research opportunity to really try to determine which are better and provide those, that information.
So this 2013 Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act requires that all schools receiving these funds actually implement prevention programming that teaches safe and positive bystander intervention to prevent harm or intervene when there is a risk of violence. That's the language in the law there.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not mandatory? You don't have to. Not every student has to go through this. Why wouldn't they be? Why wouldn't universities and colleges just say this is something that we do? You have to attend it once, at least once in your college career, or once a semester, or at the start. Why aren't they mandatory?
I think this is part of our larger cultural shift, right? So it's about embedding these types of programs at different spaces and places on our campuses in order to. Really, I think, get some of that buy-in. I feel very fortunate working at UNC Charlotte that we have super supportive administration that is allowing me to do a lot of this stuff that I need to do on campus. But I do think that there's nationwide, it's just a new thing. It's new. And then whenever there's something new, we want to know research, we want to know numbers, and those things don't exist yet. So we try on different types, right? So I embed bystander intervention into every single program. It's not just a single program.
I see.
Because if I'm asked out to teach about consent for 30 minutes, then I have to put it in there somehow because I might not get that audience again. And so in the beginning, I said repetition is key. Well, on a college campus of 28,000 students, it's difficult to repeat over and over with the same individuals.
That's Nicole Madonna-Rosario, interpersonal violence education specialist with UNC Charlotte. We're also here with Melissa Ciclo-Barrios from the county and Dr. Ann Coker. We're going to come back and talk more about these bystander programs and how they work at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Aldersgate, undergoing a transformative expansion of its 234-acre campus that will include 62 new apartments and villas. Details at aldersgateccrc.com. Cases of the Zika virus have been reported in at least 21 countries in the Caribbean and North and South America. The mosquito-borne virus is suspected of causing brain damage in infants and paralysis in adults. Guest host Indira Lakshman and a panel of experts will talk about efforts to control the spread of this disease and prospects for a vaccine coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. Want to join our conversation? Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
This year, the World Economic Forum coincides with what's been a wild ride on the world's markets, and China is at the center of it all.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
NASCAR CEO Brian France says the sport is coming off one of its most exciting seasons.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE, excuse me, and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Dr. Ann Coker, professor of epidemiology at the University of Kentucky Center for Research on Violence Against Women. She is at UNC Charlotte today at 2 o'clock to talk about these bystander programs and about domestic sexual violence and other kinds of violence on campus. Nicole Medano-Rosario is with UNC Charlotte, and Melissa Siegel Barrios is an information education coordinator with Mecklenburg County. You mentioned the Taylor Swift song. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, okay. But this is Taylor Swift, and the song is called
Blank Space.
Blank Space. Mm-hmm. You see how familiar I am with it. Let's hear a little bit of this song.
Nice to meet you. My next mistake, love's a game, wanna play. New money, suit and tie, I can read you like a magazine. Ain't it funny, rumors fly, and I know you heard about me. So hey, let's be friends, I'm dying to see how this one ends. Grab your passport and my hand, I can make the bad guys good for a weekend. So it's gonna be forever.
Okay, I'm having trouble hearing what you say I should hear in this. And she says that this is all satirical.
And I'm sure that was what her intention was. And it's the same for many artists that depict these types of lyrics in their songs.
But I didn't hear anything.
So the
am I just dense?
No. So the way that I teach this song in my workshops is I go verse by verse. Okay. Because the way that she sets up the song is almost – it mimics the way a relationship is set up that's going to become violent. So in the beginning, she's talking about and the imagery that matches in her video is everything's fine and they're riding horses and they're having fun together and they're dating. Mm-hmm. But she is telling him up front, like, this is what's going to happen. I'm crazy. And because you're here with me, then you accept it. Right? Because – and it's okay.
Off the air, you pointed out that if this kind of song were put out by –
Eminem, because he has.
We'd go ballistic.
Yeah.
Is part of the problem that I didn't hear it because it's coming from a woman? Is that why I didn't hear it?
When I do this workshop, and I did many of these workshops last semester, as did my graduate assistants, we often hear lots of things in defense of Taylor, which is fine. And we often hear that they don't get it, right? I don't get it. I don't understand what you're talking about, miss. Uh-huh. So I now break it down by verse. And the first verse is what happens in normal relationships, even healthy relationships. The beginning is fun. We're all getting our butterflies in our tummies and we're wrapped up in what's going on. The second verse of this song, things switch. She starts getting jealous. In the video, she takes his phone and throws it in the fountain because he's not paying attention to her, or maybe he's texting someone. And when I ask my students what they think is going on, many of them justify that behavior by saying, well, he must have been texting another woman. But we don't know that. There's no evidence, which is exactly what happens in violent relationships.
And even if he were, is that okay? An okay way to react in
right,
a relationship,
exactly.
To handle a problem that you're having.
Exactly.
And you're feeling jealous.
So these bystander programs mm-hmm. rely on you understanding these signals.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them overt, some of them not so overt.
Right.
Like in that song, for instance, to recognize situations or behaviors that may become violent mm-hmm. or that reinforce social norms supportive of violence. Mm-hmm. How difficult a task is that for you to in these bystander programs to transmit that information so that people understand what they're looking for.
Well, let me ask, because this you're really setting up the lyrics to this are a great setup for how we teach students to identify situations that could become violent.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you keep going on in terms of what you're talking about, and because what we do, let me just say, what we do in bystander programs is twofold. One is to educate in terms of what situations may become violent for that individual and for the people in their social circle, but also to identify situations that could become violent in others.
Mm-hmm.
So for self and others. And so I'm sure part of the reason that you're talking about this song is it provides that opportunity for identification.
Right. And one of the things that I think we all do is, you know, there are certain songs that I listen to that I absolutely love, but I know that the lyrics are not necessarily depicting healthy things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not telling people not to listen to these songs or this music. And, you know, I grew up in New York City and some of that hip hop from when I was a kid is not great, but I love it and it's okay. But think critically, right? And then the issue with this song for me that after doing this for the entire last semester is the lack of knowledge that winds up coming out when I'm teaching about initial signs of abuse, which mm-hmm. is this possessive controlling mm-hmm. behavior, wanting to control who you talk to, who you don't talk to. And you know, it's not necessarily a realistic setting that she's doing this stuff in. But the reality is that pretty much no one had a problem with her taking the phone away
mm-hmm.
Without questioning him, without asking, without having a conversation about it. And so by slowing the song down in my workshop, and almost most of the time it's the whole thing, I don't even get to the rest of my material, I incorporate signs of abusive relationships that's in the Red Flag Campaign, which is a really effective program out of Virginia, and talk to them conversationally. It's not a PowerPoint. It's just playing the song and breaking it down. And we have conversations about it. And by the end of the workshop, most people are at least knowledgeable about 5 out of the 10 top signs, let's say. And then we talk about how you as a friend who's witnessing this can intervene.
Which is a direct example of a bystander behavior.
Right.
Okay. So it's identifying the risky situation and then figuring out what you as an individual can do.
Well, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Because you're asking a young person, and we know that particularly young men don't have great judgment until they're about 27 or 28 because their brains are still
mm-hmm.
forming.
Mm-hmm.
You're asking a young person to take on, to shoulder a lot of responsibility and put a lot at risk by being a bystander who will come forward and intervene in something like this.
So when we talk about intervening, we're not necessarily talking about an individual intervening. There are a range of different ways that you can work within your social network. So it may be examples of you see perhaps the setting of this particular song.
Mm-hmm.
So having someone come up to the Taylor Swift character in this situation and talk perhaps directly to her. It may be involving the partner. It may be a friend, getting someone else within the friend circle to intervene. So it's not necessarily that individual that sees it that is responsible for doing it. So there's a delegation component, disrupting behaviors. There are all a range of different approaches mm-hmm. that students learn how to do. That's part of the training. It's identification of the learning how to identify a particular situation that could be risky, and then how to intervene. And that how to intervene is a large part of the bystander programming.
And that's also about changing the youth culture,
yep.
right? To help them see that intervening is a good thing.
Yep.
And so all of them together should be working together to stop this violence mm-hmm. from happening.
So that was going to be my next point, that you're trying to create a culture where this is the this is the expected behavior
among people
when you see something like
exactly.
this.
Yeah.
Everybody
exactly right.
gets involved.
Yep. Yes.
You've been studying the effectiveness. I know your studies aren't through on this,
uh-huh.
but are you discovering that these programs do have an impact on lessening violence
yep.
on campuses?
So we've done two different studies, and you mentioned the high school study. I'll talk about that mm-hmm. in just a minute. But in the college study, and this is something that I'm going to present this afternoon, we're comparing a campus, which is just so happens to be the campus that I work for, the University of Kentucky, which has had the Green Dot program, which is one type of bystander program. We're comparing it to two other campuses – that don't have a bystander program, we're seeing a 20% reduction in sexual violence and other forms, so sexual harassment as well as dating violence. So 20% reduction in violence is big for programming like this.
Is violence being reduced mm-hmm. because of intervention? Or is it being reduced because the abusers themselves are going through these programs, not because they think of themselves as abusers, they're just going through it with everybody else, mm-hmm. and they take a step back and recognize they're going down a bad path?
So we're talking about we use the language of mechanism. So how does the program work? So bystander programs can work in both ways that you described. So, for example, it is because everybody in a community gets the same program. So that they – one of the real advantages of an awareness-based and then an intervention-based program is the individual who may have used those behaviors in the past recognizes, oh, this is violent behavior. You mentioned this early in the hour. You mentioned maybe I did these things when I was a youngster, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what we learn in the awareness part. But the other is the engagement of others in keeping each other safe. So it's that community component. Mm. Both are parts of how a program can reduce violence.
And if the culture's changed and it's no longer okay for someone to mm-hmm. act in that way, that also makes that person less likely to perpetrate the abuse in the future.
I want to point out that I didn't engage in those activities because I was angelic in my youth. Maggie emails, please use this time and your audience's attention to teach that all humans can abuse. It's not just men on women. The numbers might be lower, but the effect on the person and their families is just as dramatic. I think we've kind of
absolutely
alluded to that.
Yeah. And one thing that we know to be true is abuse happens everywhere, yeah. right? To anybody. It doesn't discriminate. The issue for me when I teach about this is that the injury and fatality rate for women who mm-hmm. are abused, especially in a domestic violence or dating violence situation, is exponentially higher. Mm-hmm. So it is important to look at everybody and the effects on everyone, mm-hmm. But to remember that homicides happen mostly with people who are female, mm-hmm. right?
And also not to stick to the binary of male and female, right. and remember that people identify across the spectrum in all.
Let's talk about that for a second, because that's mm-hmm. something that's very difficult for a lot of people to yeah. understand. This is not just a heterosexual situation.
Absolutely, yeah.
This affects gays and lesbians. It affects transgender people, mm-hmm. particularly. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yeah. So when we talk about the numbers, we're seeing similar, if not higher, numbers with people who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and particularly people who identify as trans. And I just want to clarify that when we talk about lesbian, gay, bisexual, we're talking about sexual identity, whereas when we're talking about people who identify as trans, we're talking about gender identity.
And there is a difference.
Yes, there is a difference. And Time Out Youth is a great organization mm-hmm. that yes. we work very closely with here in the community. And they work with us to help implement prevention programming in their space to talk with young people who identify as LGBTQ, as well as allies about this issue, and really be able to talk about it in a space that's safe for them to have these conversations. And also when we go into the schools and talk about this, we're talking about it in a way that's inclusive of people who identify across the spectrum.
These bystander programs, mm-hmm. I know they're being implemented on college campuses because the law insists.
Right.
Are they being instituted at the high school level? If the problem begins in middle school, are they being instituted in middle school?
Well, I'm going to just use this opportunity to talk about Centers for Disease Control and Prevention funded intervention. It's a randomized intervention trial. It's the only one that's been done. There's one now in place in New England. What we found in that trial is that there was a 50% reduction in all forms of violence, and particularly sexual violence perpetration. So to see that level of reduction, which means that the rates of violence in those high schools that were randomized to receive bystander program relative to those that weren't, 50% reduction is pretty dramatic. So what we did in that trial is we then provided all the schools that were controls, had not received the bystander program, they received those programs. But there is not a requirement mm-hmm. to date that bystander programs need to be in high schools.
Facebook comment, as we've been talking, thank you for your very important program this morning. Another song that always struck me as particularly violent is Carrie Underwood's song, in which she details destroying her boyfriend's truck
yes.
with a knife, mm-hmm. a bat, and a crowbar. Mm-hmm. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Well, then, of course, there's Bobby Darin's Mac the Knife. Conrad on Facebook, please address personality disorders mm-hmm. like narcissistic personality disorder, mm-hmm. bipolar disorder, autism spectrum disorder. and how they play into unhealthy relationships. Also, family of origin issues and how behaviors are passed down through generations, which we kind of talk about, that hurt people hurt people. Mm-hmm.
So mental health issues are, for those of us in this work who also do treatment, it's very touchy because there is not a direct 100% correlation between personality disorder and this behavior. There's no evidence that supports that.
Okay.
And that's something that's important to remember, because one of the things that happens culturally is we look for a lot of reasons why people act this way. And sometimes it's stress. Sometimes it's anger management. Sometimes it's mental health issues. Sometimes it's alcoholism. Or there's a lot of reasons that could factor into. But when you take them out, it's still about power and control and that individual's desire for that, which is not related necessarily all the time to mental health issues.
Nelda writes, sometimes the offender takes it out on the other when they have been called out. So suggest, if you can, ways to minimize that risk. If you're a bystander and you're getting involved and suddenly the person is being called out, what do you do to minimize they're doing something later on after you go away?
Well, it's key to understand, especially on the college campuses, and this is what I tell my students, you're not superheroes. We're not getting a cape at the end of bystander training, right? Mm-hmm. We're not super people. There's lots and lots of ways to intervene. And intervention could be walking away and dialing campus police or 911 if you're in the community. And you can be anonymous doing those things. Mm-hmm. On our campus, we have a new app called LiveSafe, and you can literally go on and text and take a picture of the scene and walk away, and it goes directly to campus police.
I only have 30 seconds left. Mm-hmm. We've heard a lot of these stories about violence on campus and the victims going to the college and the adjudication process being woeful and almost antithetical to the American jurisprudence system. Is that improving? How is it at UNC Charlotte?
I think we're working to create a system of equity that is also in line with what the laws are telling us that we need to be doing for our survivors as well as for the accused. And I think that we're doing a really good job with that right now.
Nicole Madonna-Rosario is an interpersonal violence education specialist at UNC Charlotte. Melissa Siegel-Barrios is an information education coordinator with Mecklenburg County Community Support Services. And Dr. Ann Coker is in town because of UNC Charlotte to talk about these intervention programs and more today at 2 o'clock. She's with the University of Kentucky Center for Research on Violence Against Women. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte.